The method of medical diagnosis was first recorded in ancient Egypt around 2600 years BC. Hello and welcome to this week's Urgent Bite, brought to you by the Royal New Zealand College of Urgent Care. My name is Guy Melrose and today we're going to hear a talk given at the inaugural Urgent Care Bootcamp earlier this year. Dr. Matt Wright is a Fellow of the Royal New Zealand College of Urgent Care and a member of the College Executive Committee, who works clinically in the Middlemore Hospital Emergency Department. He also holds an MBA and has an interest in quality improvement, particularly within urgent care. In his talk, Matt looks at how to approach diagnosis and how to apply frameworks that will enable us to avoid making misdiagnoses.
So when I originally was going to do this talk, I said it was going to be on quality urgent care, and it is. But I'm going to concentrate more on diagnosis and how to improve it, as opposed to some of the other work which I do as more kind of, I guess, broader quality initiatives. And that's what I'm sort of interested in as my non-medical slant. I'm actually going to talk about what you can actually think about within your own practice and how to improve your own thinking about how you work with diagnosis and the quality in that. So let's jump into a quick short case history. So a 6-year-old Indian boy presents to your clinic. They've got no past medical history and they had a recent illness, but it's now settled. They present with ankle pain and do the ACC forms because the mother thinks that, you know, she watched the child had a fall, had an injury, and since then has had a sore ankle. And the child is quite tired, but otherwise well. The temp's 37.4, the range of motion about 50%, and the ankle's generally tender. The child is non-weight bearing. The treating doctor does an x-ray, which is normal, and treats it as a clinical fracture, and says, let's put it in a cast for a week and review. Sounds reasonable. So now moving into kind of just thinking about diagnosis, why is it that we should concentrate on diagnosis? Well, Gurpreet Dhaliwal, who's a real deep thinker around diagnosis, diagnostic theory in America, and teaches a lot of students, talks about the fact that the diagnosis is actually the clinician's most critical procedure. And the doctors, those of you in the room here, are the ones which mostly do it, not all. And things are changing a little bit with nurse practitioners and other healthcare professionals do it. But generally, it sets other healthcare professionals apart from doctors because the majority of what you do is diagnosis. This is a quote from Tony Alessandra. In selling as in medicine, prescription before diagnosis is malpractice. Now, if I asked you in the room here to put up your hand if you have prescribed something to decrease someone's symptoms, and then actually once they've got better, sent them home without a diagnosis, I think probably all of you, you know, in the room would put your hand up, and I know that I would. But he's taking this from the sales art, but just thinking it is actually one of those things that, you know, that you just have to be careful when you mask someone's symptoms to say what actually is the underlying diagnosis. William Osler, who's one of the fathers of modern medicine, says, listen to your patient. He is telling you the diagnosis. And this comes with the fact that taking an accurate history, looking at the information, you know, you should be able to make the diagnosis. And Ralph Green, who's an American doctor, sort of says, if you can make the diagnosis, the treatment is easy and the damage can be reversed. But actually making that diagnosis is much more tricky than we think. And at medical school, you're taught, if you learn this stuff, you know, you will make the right diagnosis, your patients will get better. But we know that actually doesn't happen. So Jerome Groopman, who's a doctor from America, who's done a lot of thinking in this, wrote a book called How Doctors Think, and it's fascinating to read, and I encourage you all to read this. And in that book, and in consistent literature, 15% of diagnoses made by doctors are wrong. That's across the board. Some studies it's 10, some studies it's more like 18 to 20, but that's 1 in every 7 patients, in general, the diagnosis is wrong. So if you think about the number of patients which you see in your clinic, in a normal sort of 25, 30 patients, you're probably getting around about 5 per day wrong. And the ED, I see about 12 sort of patients per day, so I'm probably getting it wrong in 2 patients. And even if you're the best clinician and you're the most thorough, you will be making errors. Diagnosis error is so important. There's actually a whole society to improve diagnosis in medicine. And I've been to one of their conferences, and it was fascinating the different things which you can do to improve diagnosis. And there's also a website which you can go to, which has got a whole bunch of papers, and that's in your references, which I've attached with you. So what happens? What happens when we make wrong diagnoses? Well, actually, it's a major, major issue. It's the most common, catastrophic and costly to make a diagnostic error. One in three malpractice cases, this is all American literature, is due to inaccurate or delayed diagnosis. 1.8 billion in payouts because of that. Now, I know money's a dirty word and we don't really talk about it, but that's a lot of money. And 71% of high severity malpractice claims. And the severity thing is the thing I'd like to focus on. And that goes with that, is that 74% of misdiagnoses are due to cancers, vascular events, and infections. So if you're thinking of the big things that you don't want to miss, you think of the high morbidity things, they are going to be cancers, they're going to be infections, and they're going to be vascular events. On a daily basis, we all have massive information overload. We have people coming at us, you hit your clinic, and straight away people are at you, they're asking you questions, you've got emails coming in. You've got a lot of reasons why you can't actually concentrate on that patient in front of you to make the most accurate diagnosis. And so why is it that actually you make diagnostic error? What are the diagnostic failures? The two key things are clinical reasoning errors. And Guy touched on it before when he talked about bias. So the first one is premature closure. That's the fact that when you see someone with dysuria, you think, oh, UTI, quick, antibiotics, great, see you later. You don't expand to think, could this be an STD? Could this be bladder cancer? Those sorts of things. And then the second thing is failure to consider an important cause. Not everything that meows is a cat. And so these are the two main things in your practice that, two main errors which we know cause diagnostic issues. So how do you combat these? The first is improving it at an individual clinician level. Every single one of you, challenge yourself to think critically about your practice. Try to use frameworks for differentials. Try to make differentials in the first point. And then the second thing is, as a system, we should be supporting you. And we, as in the other roles that I play, is actually about how to improve diagnosis across the board. Decision support tools, of which I'll come to just kind of a number of those, that are both for diagnosis and for management, should be utilized, should be available, and you should know where to go. So when we actually look at sort of how to make diagnosis, this is the approach which I make and a lot of the clinicians which I work with do. So if you're gonna frame up a differential, you can frame it up by anatomy. You can look at which organs could be involved. You could do it by system. Is it neurological? Is it musculoskeletal? Those sorts. The one that I like the most is the surgical sieve. It's the most time consuming, but it's the most accurate and most all-encompassing. And then a quicker option is what's very important and what's very common. And it's often the way which, as you become a more senior clinician, you naturally think, right, what's it probably going to be? Commonness. And what don't I want to miss? Importance. And it's a good approach as well. So if we're thinking actually what decision support tools could you use? Well, they've got things like the Oxford Clinical Handbook, which moved from those something you put in your white coat when you're a medical student. When I was a medical student, white coats were just being phased out, to now being online. You've got things like UpToDate, which are good for diagnosis, but very heavy. Life in the Fast Lane is a really good resource. Things like Isabel and DDX, which are actually purely about the diagnosis at the bedside. BMJ best practice, and then there's always Dr. Google. But I would very much caution you if Google is your approach to diagnosis when you're not sure. So practically, what I'm challenging you to do is for 1 minute before seeing every patient, just remind yourself of the important differentials. Just think what is common and what is important here. And just for 1 minute before finishing the consult, have you safeguarded yourself? Have you checked what things you don't want to miss? And just as a quick example of how this might work from an IT perspective, this up here is a way of approaching this patient's ankle pain. He's a 2 to 5 year old, he's a male. There are common things which we know happen to 2 to 5 year olds which cause their ankle pain. Distal fibular fractures, which is in the bones. The skin can have insect bites, injuries, cellulitis, and the soft tissue can have sprains. The original doctor thought, it's probably a common thing. It maybe doesn't necessarily fit into any of these categories specifically, but I'm gonna kind of call it a sprain or a distal fibular fracture. And I'm going to do my X-ray. I'm going to check there's no external wounds. I'm going to put it in a cast. That's probably fine, actually, at week at week one. But this patient came back and continued to have symptoms. And this is when you start to think, actually, what are these things which I don't want to miss? I don't want to miss septic arthritis. They had a 50% range of motion, so it's less likely. Compound fracture, well, I would have noticed that at the time. Could they have osteomyelitis? Or actually, could they have rheumatic fever? And so when you set about thinking about things in a framework setup, you actually put yourself, test yourself, and actually help yourself think clearly so that you can actually make the right diagnosis. So when I go back to this case history here, we've got our boy, and some of you may have already said, oh, it doesn't sound quite right. So when this child had their cast off, they had a heavy limp, the temp was 37.8, and they did a re-x-ray, which was normal. And instead of at that stage going, okay, that does not sound right, we know that if an ankle sprain after a week should be completely settled, they actually were treated for another week in tubicum and crutches and told, oh, come back in, you know, a week to 10 days, time if you're getting better, hoping they would. They got a new rash, they were sent to hospital, they had an ASO antibody titer, they had carditis and a very poor prognosis. I had a summary slide, but it looks like I won't be showing that. Think about diagnosis, use frameworks, and you can do better even with limited time. Thank you.
In the show notes, there are links to some of the resources Matt mentions in his talk. Taking the time, as he suggests, to think through your diagnosis, utilising frameworks and decision support tools, will help us all deliver better quality urgent care. If you have any comments, questions, corrections or suggestions, email podcast@rnzcuc.org.nz, or you can pop over to Facebook and leave a comment there. If you have Twitter, follow the college @rnzcuc. Now we'll be back next week with another podcast. I look forward to seeing you all then, but for now, thanks for listening.